Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Episode of GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast, where we are happy to say there are people tuning into this podcast in over 130 countries around the world. Thank you so much for doing that. All of our guests and experts are always happy to share their thoughts and stories with you. And this week we have Ian Mitchell joining us. Now, Ian is a senior fellow and the director of development cooperation in Europe at the Center for Global Development. Now, he leads the Center for Global Development's work in Europe on how governments' policies accelerate or inhibit development and poverty reduction, considering both the effectiveness of aid and policies beyond aid, including trade, migration, environment, and security. He is also an associate fellow at Chatham House and at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And Ian Mitchell has expertise in the economics and development impact, including on trade, agriculture, and policy developments in the EU and the G20. He leads the annual Commitment to Development Index and the Quality of Official Development Assistance. And recently, he has developed a new measure of how agriculture and trade policies affect lower-income countries, identified new metrics of aid for effectiveness, and developed new approaches to the UK's development policy post-Brexit. And so today, Ian Mitchell is joining us on GDP to sort of give a report card, I guess, about how well donor nations are doing when it comes to global development cooperation. Ian, welcome back to GDP.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's always great to have you join us, and thanks again for coming through. We've got a previous podcast with Ian if you want to go back in our archives and have a listen to that as well. Now, Ian, we've getting a sense of the state of development cooperation today. Who is sort of leading the charge? I mean, which countries, be it in Europe or elsewhere, are in the top place for global development cooperation today in 2023?
Thanks, Robert. Yeah, I think it's an interesting time for countries' commitment to global development. There's a lot of pressures, post-COVID, fiscal pressures. There's Russia's war in Ukraine, which maybe we'll come on to talk about. So it's interesting to assess who's still managing to maintain their commitment. And what we see in our assessment, the Commitment to Development Index, is that Sweden are top, they've been top for a number of years. Maybe people will be familiar with Sweden topping international indices, but I think they've got a very strong policy set that works for development, not just in development finance and aid, which is kind of traditionally where we focus, but they've also got policies on environment. They've got an openness to migration, good at integrating people that arrive there. And also strong policies across, lots of the areas that we assess. I suppose we have seen Sweden, they've finished top in our index for the last four times that we've done it. We have seen their lead reduce a little bit. And we've seen some of their policies in recent months and years maybe be, a little bit less supportive of global development than they have been in the past. For example, using some of their aid budget to fund refugees within their countries. So Sweden are still top, but their lead has shrunk. I guess the other countries that deserve a very honourable mention are Germany. We rank them second overall, and they're the top G7 country. They're particularly strong on investment and trade with lower income countries, also on health. And in recent years, they're probably the country that have stepped up most on development finance and particularly climate finance. So I think most people will recognize, if you follow the international meetings, that that Germany have been doing more, and they've moved up quite significantly in their index. The country in third are Norway, and they've got a really strong performance in some areas, particularly on development finance, where they give a very high proportion of their GNI as aid and finance. It quite often goes to the very poorest countries, which we think is important. Norway are held back a little bit by some of their policies on agriculture and environment. So they have a relatively protective trade regime compared to most of the countries we look at, and they have quite high subsidies for for agriculture, and of course they're quite a large producer of fossil fuels, and that also factors into our thinking.
So okay, so this is very interesting, and very different population sizes too. I mean, Germany's, you know, huge population, huge economy, and Norway just consistently seems to be punching above its weight for a country the size that it is. You know, right now in some international development circles, like there's talk about you know, our government sort of just de-investing in development, and have even the scholarship of development sort of, you know, as they say, jumped the shark. Is it something that's now it's, is it gone into a state where it's in decline, that people are turning away from it for other models or something like this? But what do you think is a motivating factor then for countries like Sweden, Germany, and Norway to continue to pursue such high levels of commitment?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it, to look at the, you know, you can see from a number of governments globally that there's been a move to focus more on national interests. I mean, both, you know, deliberately focusing on the well-being of people in the country and being seen to eschew international commitments from some countries. But other countries have maintained that interest. I mean, I suppose one area that continues to have a relatively high profile in these countries, I think, is the sustainable development goals. I think that framing of a kind of global commitment has worked better in some countries than others in terms of maintaining support. I think the other progressive area where, you know, there is popular support for international action is on climate. And I think you see that in polls. I think you see that people recognize that the industrialized countries have done a great deal of damage to the environment already, are continuing to do so, and that makes a very clear case for there to be contributions to lower income countries who are feeling the worst effects. So I think that's probably an increasing motivation for those countries that are doing more. That is a major motivation.
Right. And now who, maybe we just turn it over a little bit, like, so who isn't doing so well? Who is sort of surprisingly maybe low to midway, like large economies that we'd expect to have high commitments, but have kind of turned away from it all?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think the obvious candidate to discuss for this is the US. And we've actually been doing this exercise for 20 years now, the Commitment to Development Index. It was first published in 2003. And even then, the US you know, didn't perform well. I think it also, to some people, that's counterintuitive, because the US plays such an outsized role on the international agenda. It is the largest absolute provider of development finance globally as a single country. Although if you look at the EU collectively, it gives much more. But I think that's most people's perception. You alluded to this in your earlier question. I mean, we adjust all of our measures for the size of the country. So when we're looking at migration, we look at that relative to the domestic population. When we look at aid or development finance, we do that relative to the size of the economy. And that's where the US falls down, at least on development finance. So we look at cross-border development finance. It provides just 0.17% of its GNI as aid or cross-border finance. Even the average across all the countries is about 0.29%, and that includes quite a few middle-income countries. And the average is a bit higher amongst the higher-income countries. So I think that's the biggest one. I guess it's also worth saying with the US that, you know, that there's a lot of international agreements that I think most of us would think are worthwhile that the US doesn't sign up to. So
yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good point.
And I mean, you'll know more about this than me, but there's you know, part of the US's political structure, I think, makes it difficult to get approval to ratify international agreements. But we see that both in environment, some of the biodiversity agreements that were recently signed up to, the US hasn't reported on in the way other countries have, but also on security treaties. There's, you know, there's a number, we assess 8 or 9 security treaties, and the US has only been able to sign up to half of them. And so, you know, the vast majority of countries that we assess have managed to sign up to those and see those in international norms, but the US hasn't been able to.
Right. And is there anything in there too? I mean, you know, it's never exciting to talk about budget lines, but is there a sense where there are funds being contributed into areas that wouldn't typically be seen as a global development budget line? I'm thinking with the U.S. in particular, the size of military aid, right, that is given out there, or has there been more put towards dealing with border challenges with Mexico? And is that seemingly to take up both the budgetary but also the imaginative space about what the country is doing on a global scale? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, is it getting to a point where these interests are now in the minds of Washington qualifying as development assistance?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think when you do talk to officials in the US, some of the conversations I've had, not necessarily this administration, have said, look, you know, our contribution to global development is security. And obviously the US spends a higher proportion of its GNI on defense than almost any other country. To some extent, we recognize some of that. For example, on sea lanes protection, the US, you know, naval investment plays a big role in keeping sea lanes open, and that enables trade, which is really important to development. And we give credit for that. But I think you're right to say that we don't assess that in the same way that the US government does. And it feels that is a major contribution to global development. Whereas I think it's, you know, as the editor of this, I need to take a view. And my feeling is, while there are positives, I mean, you can think about, you know, GPS technology that may have come out of US military expenditure. And that's obviously been a global positive. I think it's much harder to argue that the expenditure the US has made on its military, you know, has benefited, is unambiguously a good thing. And yeah, I think if you compare it to the ways that development finance can be spent, or on UN peacekeeping, or on R&D, then each of those areas of expenditure, you know, would have a much bigger contribution to develop than defense does.
Yeah, and I think those strict definitions that you're working with really are important. And even at a deeper level, when you start to go into see where the development commitments are coming out and which country is doing what, you know, for me, the home team, Canada, they've past governments and sometimes current governments, you see a bit of that with these bold announcements of like, well, there will be a massive relief package going to Haiti. I remember this after the earthquake in 2010, that was so shockingly devastating to that country, that there was all this, you know, pomp and circumstance around let's match donations that Canadians are, you know, going to put towards the Red Cross. The government of Canada will match that for hurricane relief. Well, where it actually went, like if you follow the dollars at the end of it, is it went nowhere near anything that people would perceive as being boots on the ground. It was basically packaged up as a form of debt relief to French and Canadian banks. For Haiti's overseas debt. And that really wasn't the message that people thought that they were getting. They thought, well, that's not really what we view as being, you know, disaster relief, if not even development assistance. But that's another angle too. No, there's some other specificities of where the money gets spent that may go outside what we consider to be development in the end.
Yeah, I mean, a great example of that this year, which you know, to be fair to the US, it's not guilty of, is the spending of the aid budget on refugees. And so actually we adjust for that, and we say we'll only count development finance if it's cross-border and you're spending it in your own country. But I think, I mean, the UK is probably the worst offender on that in that it's now, you know, the biggest recipient of UK aid is the UK, because much being spent on hosting Ukrainian and actually not just Ukrainian refugees, but also people coming across the channel in small boats. And yeah, costs of that situation have been mismanaged and have exploded, and the government's let the aid budget take the strain, take all of the strain of that over expenditure. So that's one thing we like to look at. And the UK, we haven't got all of that data in yet, but the UK's, you know, already dropped down to seventh in the assessment.
Well, I want to come back to Ukraine in a second, but while we're on UK, you know, what has happened since Brexit? Has there been sort of a narrowing down of the former global Britain, or is this sort of, you know, has the post-Brexit era sort of seen a de-investment in development assistance altogether, or is that kind of unrelated?
I mean, no, I think it is. I mean, paradoxically, you know, because as the UK was leaving the EU, you know, it wanted to assert its independence and its own, you know, global Britain was the brand that it promoted, and it wanted to champion that distinct role from its European neighbours. And I think most people would have recognised the UK for being an absolute leader on development. And also, it used to be the only country that met both the 0.7% UN aid target and the 2% NATO defence spending target. But it has really stepped back from that leadership role. It doesn't want to be seen as the leading country on development anymore. It's happy to be in the middle of the pack. It's cut its aid budget. It merged its development department, DFID, into the Foreign Office, and has lowered its profile and expertise significantly. I guess there is some resilience in the UK's kind of policy set. So, you know, it still does. It's improved its trade for development regime, for example, and its migration profile has actually improved as well. So instead of, you know, accepting migrants from predominantly high-income EU countries, it's now accepting many more migrants from Nigeria and India, and that's doing more for global development. But in terms of the government's commitment to that leadership role, it's certainly gone. Maybe it's past the nadir now. Maybe it's on the rise again with Minister Andrew Mitchell. But it's
that's a really wild thing to think about, that politics or the political climate can move to such a degree that engaging with development just isn't appealing. We'll step away from that. We'll minimize that. That's a really powerful sentiment that I think development scholars and practitioners need to be very wary of.
And we've looked back in this CDI across the 20 years that we produced the index, and you do see the ebbing and flowing of development leadership. So the Netherlands led, you know, several of the first iterations of the assessment, but now is, you know, is down at sixth. And it makes you wonder about Sweden, you know, if we're seeing their lead starting to fall back, you know, will they see value in continued leadership on this agenda, or will they step back and will others need to step up? The other honourable mention, as you mentioned Canada earlier, I mean, they're a country that over the 20 years has improved, actually. So they didn't score very well in the early assessments, but now they score particularly well on investment, on, you know, the sort of regulation and environment for investment in lower income countries, and quite well in security and other areas. I guess the Achilles heel for Canada is on environment, and bit like Australia, the emissions in those three countries per head, you know, again, adjusting for country size, are really remarkably high and relative to most of the other countries.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing I tell my students is that here in Nova Scotia, we're one of the provinces where basically every time you turn on the lights, you're burning coal or oil, right? Like there's some provinces that are incredibly clean, but there's still parts of the country that are just deeply ground into fossil fuels. And it's a little embarrassing, to say the least. So may I ask you, though, the war in Ukraine, what impacts has this broadly had on global development? This must have shaken something up over the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was something we struggled with quite a lot. So, you know, we'd been separately researching, you know, the impact, for example, of food prices on extreme poverty. And, you know, those were global food prices are connected. They were significantly exacerbated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But actually, when you start to think about it, there were so many other impacts. So, you know, so we talked about refugees earlier, the diversion of development finance from helping lower income countries towards supporting refugees. And, you know, I'm the first to criticize the UK for that, but it was obviously triggered by the war as well. The fiscal pressure and the economic pressure on again, many of the countries that we assess, from high inflation, high oil prices, the following on of high interest rates in response to those prices, meaning that capital flows out of lower income countries. So I think we, you know, multi-layered and very significant. I mean, even independently of the direct impact on Ukraine itself, which of course is a middle income country. So in the index, you know, we assess Russia already, and they've never performed well in the index. They one of the sort of, I suppose, the signals of this potential was we look at arms exports and who countries are willing to export arms to, and the conflict potential of those countries, and Russia scored very poorly on that indicator and on the security component in general. So I guess in some way the signals were there that Russia are not committed to development, but this year we've taken some special adjustments as well to, for example, excluding sanctions against Russia from our trade measures. We don't give Russia credit for hosting Ukrainian refugees for obvious reasons, and we mark them down on, we usually measure peacekeeping contributions to the UN, but that seemed silly in the case of Russia, so we removed their, reversed their score there on that indicator. So yeah, I mean, I think that's been the major challenge to everyone's commitment to development is Russia's invasion of Ukraine and countries' ability to focus on their other developing country partners and not have their focus completely absorbed by the horrible events in Ukraine.
Yeah. And, you know, amid this right now, I mean, we've seen a couple of international forums and the UNGA was, you know, going on. Not everyone in the global South is taking as hard line against Russia's actions. There's some in there that say, well, why not? And it's led many to say, that, you know, is Russia trying to create its own development space? Is it pushing out some of the former players? And if it is, where? And if it is somewhere, where? How big of a concern should this be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear, isn't it, that Russia is seeking influence in all parts of the world, in whichever way they can. So we look at development finance, Russia's development finance, and even though it's pretty opaque, it's also pretty clear that it's not actually providing significant amounts of money in the way that we would think about it normally. But maybe there are different things that Russia can do for countries or parts of countries that will confer support. But I mean, I think you're right about the story on, you know, support for Ukraine not being as strong, you know, outside of the West. But it's not very often that you get a UN resolution with such support condemning a country. And I mean, that was one of the reasons we felt so comfortable penalizing Russia in this index. So I do think there's an emphasis, you know, there's obviously an understandable emphasis on those countries that didn't vote for that resolution condemning Russia. But I think, yeah, it's pretty unusual to get such wide condemnation of one country's actions. And I think sometimes we can forget that. And you know, there are many countries in lower income countries that did support that resolution.
Yeah, and that'll have to be, you know, the time that time will tell just how deep this potential influence is going to be. We've seen, you know, China, you know, with its Belt and Road and other initiatives, really trying to throw its weight around many countries in the global South, and how often there's some quick builds that can come into it. You know, we need a new road, we need a hospital, we need some of the ocean land reclaimed from the ocean. Like, that can come pretty quick, but then it's sort of the long-term promises and commitments that kind of get shaky. And, you know, I'm just sort of keeping my eye right now very closely on relations between Russia and Cuba, two particular players that have had a history together. But right now, since the war has broken out in Ukraine, that relationship is one that's become in many ways dependent. Cuba's depending on Russia right now as sort of the market, but yet also incredibly abusive, right? Where now we're seeing evidence of Cubans kind of being falsely coerced to actually work and serve and alongside Russian military. So we'll have to see what the long term will be for that. But for right now, I think it's I think your report is showing that we should be, should we say, thankful that we do have players like Norway Sweden and Germany who continue to take development serious. And
yeah, thank you.
In that way.
Just picking up your point, Robert. Sorry, just wanted to say one more thing on the on about kind of support. I mean, I think you can, you know, when you talk to colleagues in lower income countries, I mean, I think they would emphasize that for them, COVID and the unwillingness to share vaccines freely was a, you know, was a wake up call, I guess, for their relationships with the high income countries that we focus on in our assessment. And then I think another one will be is the climate finance target that was set in 2009. You know, I think, I mean, that differs a bit from the UN aid commitment in that, you know, this was an international agreement that was reached to provide climate finance by of 100 billion a year by 2020 that's been, you know, repeatedly missed. And so I do think there's a, there is a lack of, you know, people to refer to a lack of trust. And I think those concrete examples of policy are one of the reasons why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are great points, Ian. Thanks so much. Well, Ian, good luck with the you know, the future research on this, and continue to do what you do to give us the numbers and the data that we can keep digesting and really seeing what's going on in the world of development. Ian Mitchell from the Center for Global Development in London, joined us from London today. What's been here on GDP, sort of giving us the global development report card in many ways. Ian, thank you so much for being part of GDP.
Great. Thanks for having me. Look up the tool and let us know if you think we should be measuring development differently.